suerte de contar con David Schmitz, que es uno de los grandes filósofos de nuestro tiempo, un experto en todo lo que es la tradición liberal. Es además editor en jefe del Cambridge Press, ¿no es cierto? El Social Philosophy and Policy Journal, y un referente obligado en toda la discusión sobre materias de economía política, filosofía política y social. Él, obviamente, es el jefe del Departamento de Economía Política y Moral Sciences de la Universidad de Arizona. David, thank you very much for being here. I have to say that we have the Spanish edition of your book ready for our readers, so they can go and buy it at the Foundation for Progress and the bookstores, because we will distribute it to all bookstores. And
thank you. I'm honored and excited by that.
No, and we will have you as soon as normality returns here in Chile, discussing your book with Jason Brennan. And I also have, this is my favorite book, Elements of Justice, and talking about other topics. But this particular issue of Atomo, that's the name of this magazine, it's about violence. And why? Because we had severe crisis last year in Chile, where you could see in the news all over very extreme scenes of people destroying the subway, people, attacking and looting shops and shopping malls and supermarkets, and it was a chaos, a complete collapse of social law and public order, and the government had to call the military. So we had a state of emergency, and the military had to bring back order and by using force. So the topic of violence is interesting because a large part of the political class in Chile were justifying these acts, saying that this was a reaction against unfair neoliberalism and a system that had created too much inequality and so on and so forth. And many intellectuals on the left were saying the same thing, not only in Chile, but also worldwide. Like the New York Times even published an article saying, oh, this is the fault of inequality in Chile and so on and so forth. So I would like to begin with a general question, which has to do with, we know that violence is a problem in any society. It can happen, criminality or gangs organized, or you can have civil war or whatever. So what's the classical or the appropriate response to violence? What's the classical liberal approach, or what would be your approach to how do we deal with violence, and why is it such an important issue? Because this is not obvious to everyone. What are your reflections on that? How do we cope with violence in a society?
Well, it's yeah, it's really difficult, Axel. Violence has always been part of human cultures. Before we were human beings, we were people who had to deal with the issue. And so if you say, why do we have to deal with the issue? There's a fundamental question about our human nature, which is, first of all, we are social animals, which means that our way of surviving is to learn how to cooperate with each other. So, it's not like we have any special excellence as hunters or something like that. We can't fly. We don't have gills. We don't have claws, or we can't run at 70 miles an hour the way a cheetah does. So, the way we have our human way of survival is to cooperate. And we're not just social animals. The second thing to say is that we're also essentially political animals, which is to say our ability to cooperate is premised on our ability to negotiate. It's premised on politics. We have to make deals. We don't just simply cooperate. we cooperate in the execution of deals that we've made with each other. And so we need a way of, we need two things. First of all, we need to be able to trust each other to be nonviolent. We need to be able to trust each other to understand the agreements that we've made and keep those agreements. So that goes beyond just keeping the peace. So we need something like contract law, not just basic criminal law protecting us physically. What else to say about that? I could let that go. Just put a period on that. That to say we're social and political animals, and everything starts from there. And so violence is one way of understanding the issue of violence, is to say we have to be able to trust each other in order to be able to survive and flourish as the kinds of social animals we are, and as a result, as the kind of cooperators that we are. Now, that means we have to be able to live close together, and we have to be neighbors without spending all of our time defending our moats and our fortresses and so on, spending all our time hiring guards. We have to grow crops, or we have to produce items that can be of benefit to our neighbors, so that we have something to trade with them, which is to say some basis for cooperating with them and some basis for them wanting to cooperate with us. So we have to be able to let down our defenses. We have to be able to keep the peace and to minimize the cost of keeping the peace. That is, in a way, the first imperative of civilization. It's what the whole idea of civilization is premised on, being able to keep the peace. So if you said, what would be, and go ahead and stop me, interrupt me anytime that you want, Axel. But I would say, if you ask then, what actually is that problem? What is it that leads us to violence? Well, distrust is what leads us to violence. And distrust and the possibility of trust leads us to be tribal. We're tribal animals. Our politics is tribal. So we have to separate ourselves into the groups of people that you can trust and the groups of people, well, you're not so sure that you can trust. You don't have histories of being able to trust them, so you're not so sure. So anyone that, you know, has a different accent from you, anyone who speaks a different language altogether, anyone who doesn't look like you, anyone who's a different race, and maybe in human history, above all, anybody who has a different religion, they're part of a different tribe. And so you have to be careful with them. You have to explore, figure out what is the cost minimizing way of establishing that you can be trusted, which is to say establishing a reputation for someone that it's good to make deals with, trust someone, trust in each other as cooperative partners. So that also implicates the idea of a rule of law. It has to emerge either formally or informally by custom and mutual expectation. The peace, expectation of peace, has to emerge because nothing works without that. But because part of our response to that is tribal, the tribalism creates its own risk of violence, because you start to see other tribes as people that maybe you ask yourself if you should be trying to strike the first blow, fire the first shot, and eliminate them as threats before they can get off the ground as threats. So one way in which we form religions in order to have the markers of a team. We're on the same team, we're members of the same tribe, we wear the same uniform, we're all Catholics, or whatever it is that we are. And that means that if we're all Catholics, then that means, well, Muslims aren't part of the club. Buddhists, Jews, they're not part of the club. And that's, so that creates its own threat. As it secures the peace inside the group, it destabilizes it by making groups into groups. It also creates the prospect of tribal violence. And so religion emerged in Europe as Western civilization as really an anarchic force, as a force that made people absolutely viciously tribal, murderously tribal. And nowadays, people, you talk to young people about, if you say Western civilization, more than anything else, it's an answer to the question of how to turn your religion into something that isn't a reason to kill you. And when you tell students about that history, they are shocked at that religion was important in that way. And they say, well, we've just got to ban religion. So yeah, well, that's always been part of our religion too. If we could just ban religion, meaning other people's religion, right. Yeah, that's war. That's not peace.
That's war, right.
So Western civilization, the genius of Western civilization is it managed to develop the concept of minding your own business, even to the point of making your own choices about how to save your eternal soul. And when our Bibles would say, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, or thou shalt not suffer a heathen to live, we just learn to think of that as metaphorical and kind of ignore it. That was the basic premise of Western civilization and why Western civilization has flourished.
So you don't agree with this theory that Western civilization is oppressive and has been created for the benefit of minorities, like not minorities, but maybe the white men, and that discriminates, all sorts of minorities. All this postmodern rhetoric about Western civilization being an instrument for colonialism and then for slavery in the U.S., for instance, and all these, accusations you read basically on the left, mostly, but the patriarchy, another theme that comes, it was designed to oppress women. How would you respond to that? Because many young people now at universities, they are reading a lot, especially in the humanities, about this identity politics arguments, no? Which is bringing back tribalism in a way as well.
Well, yeah, thank you. That's a good question. And I don't know if there's any such thing as a good answer. But the last thing you said was the beginning of an answer, which is to say, what has emerged is one group attempting to coalesce into a tribe, and they're coalescing into a tribe by othering some other tribe. So people, the other tribe gets demonized, the other tribe gets called a patriarchy or whatever you want. But have to understand, first of all, that there's some truth to the accusation that that humanity does have a history of being sexist, and Western civilization is not special in that regard, except for the degree to which it eventually transcended sexism.
Right.
Slavery is almost universal in human history. I don't mean that everywhere has been a slave society, but I don't want to discuss what percentage of societies have been slave societies. It depends on how you define terms. But the fact is, literal, like people in chains, bondage, slavery has existed for as long as recorded human history has been around to document it. The first recorded written language instruments discovered were clay tablets that had to do with basically receipts to document that a transaction had occurred in which people had bought themselves out of slavery. That goes back at least to 4000 BC, the first written language we know of, Sumerian.
Right.
And those were the first written documents were people buying themselves out of slavery and getting receipts to document that in fact they were freemen, even though they were not members of this culture. They were in transit to go back home, but as they were passing through to get home, they were passing through as free men. That's the those accounting instruments were the first the oldest written documents that we have. So slavery is old. It's been reinstituted again and again. It's been abolished again and again. One thing for Western civilization to say is, if we've made progress, then if you look at our history will be embarrassing. Our history is embarrassing, and it's partly because we have made progress.
Right.
So we did in fact abolish slavery. Does slavery still exist? Well, in various ways, yeah, it still does. I mean, there's sex trafficking. There's, in various ways.
We know it's wrong.
Various places, yeah, it still exists. We know that it's wrong. We condemn it, and that's what we can do is we can try to learn from our mistakes and rectify them, which we have done to some extent, which cannot be done in a completely satisfactory way. There's no such way as we can't do time travel. We can't abolish slavery retroactively. It was real, and it was a terrible thing. And because it's a terrible thing, it has lasting effects. The lasting effects are not themselves slavery, but they are bad. I mean, ghettos are terrible places. And I guess you could say that the races and minorities, religions that make up ghettos aren't the same as make up other neighborhoods. So it is harder. It's a harder life to be born black, but mainly, I don't think that's because, it's partly because it's just plain harder to be born black, but mainly it's because it's harder to be born in a ghetto. It's harder to be born in those places. Those places are, one has less opportunity if one is born in those places.
Right. Which is true also for different ethnicities, no? If you are born in a ghetto, Do you think, to what extent do you believe that Thomas Hobbes was right in the sense that we need a government, we need a state that has the capacity to impose violence in a way or to order society through violence in a orderly manner, applied violence? Do we need a Leviathan? Do we need... a government. James Madison also said, if men were angels, we would not need to, any government. And also we need to control government because those who govern us are not angels themselves. So there are also some theories about anarchism. And so I would like to hear your reflection on that. To what extent do you think Hobbes was right? It's a very green world. I don't think that Madison had in mind the same that Hobbes had, but there is some point there. Like, we need someone who monopolizes force so we can live together and not fall into this tribal conflicts. What do you make of that argument?
Well, thanks also for asking that question, Axel. First of all, Hobbes had a beautiful mind. He was a brilliant thinker and a brilliant writer. He is one of the inventors of liberalism without himself having been a liberal. But here's how it works. Philosophy, we separate egoism into ethical egoism and psychological egoism. And psychological egoism is the premise that people relentlessly and exclusively pursue their own interests. Now, so we classify Hobbes as a psychological egoist, and then we read a little bit of his work, and then we poke holes in psychological egoism. I think the fact is Hobbes was not a psychological egoist, because Hobbes believed that there were two driving impulses in human nature. One was good and one was bad. The good impulse was self-interest, and that was a dominant force in the normal course of human affairs and human interactions. That was inclined us toward peace and trade, minding our own business, laying low, and just trying to get through the day and secure ourselves, secure our own futures as best we could. That was the good part of human nature. The bad part of human nature was vanity, and vanity is not a form of self-interest. It's directly contrary to self-interest. Vanity is the idea that when we're born, we have a perspective and we grow up being treated as if we're the center of the universe, and we think of ourselves as the center of the universe. And then we start encountering people who don't see us as the center of the universe. They see themselves as the center of the universe. And because of that, we hate them. And we want to get revenge against them for failing to see that we are the center of the universe. So that's vanity. And so we are tempted. We get into fights for no reason, that like it isn't in our interest to get into fights, but we get into them anyway because we think someone has insulted us. And in a way they have. From our perspective, they've insulted us, but from their own perspective, they're just proceeding from what seems to them to be an obvious fact, which is they are the center of the universe. Anything they look at, it revolves around them. They're at the center of the scene always. So that's the idea. Now, then Hobbes came up with basic laws of nature, but the laws of nature were in effect laws of self-interest as well. And the idea of the laws was to correct our vanity and create a social infrastructure that corrects our vanity and that intimidates our vanity. It's not supposed to intimidate our self-interest. It's supposed to intimidate and strike fear into our vanity. So one of the main laws of nature is keep your contracts at least when you can trust others to keep theirs. That's not strict self-interest. That's a game theory notion of reciprocity. And that was at the center of Hobbes's philosophy. So even his self-interest was the self-interest of a social animal, not the self-interest of a hermit or a solitary animal. Our self-interest was in being a person that is good to make deals with.
Right.
And that is the self-interest of a uniquely, characteristically, the self-interest of a social animal, which is to be trustworthy, to be someone who is a good person to make deals with. So yeah, that's Hobbes in my version of Hobbes in a nutshell.
So, but you still believe that then government has to control, like I'm thinking about what happened in Chile, like we had a collapse in public order, property rights were not respected, people were attacking, destroying private and public property, and it was chaos. Everyone was looting, suddenly supermarkets and all that. So in your view, it was very opportunistic. That would be a proper role of government to bring that back to normality, like by force.
Yes, I do think that would be a proper role of government. But let's go back to the way you've asked the question at least two times. The question being, do we need government?
Right, right.
And in a way, what I want to say is, I'm not sure that that's the right question to ask. So you might say something like, do we need markets? Well, it depends on what you mean. You might say, can I imagine a situation in which we just learn to photosynthesize, and so we don't need to trade anymore? We don't need to be cooperative animals anymore. We can just be like plants. Well, I guess in terms of like logical possibility, no, we don't need markets. If you said, do we need oxygen? Well, theoretically, we could develop into the kind of creatures that that can just breathe in carbon dioxide and break that down and get the oxygen we need from that. So theoretically, we don't need oxygen. In the same way, theoretically, we don't need governments, but we've got them. So I think the real question is, what should they do? And I would say that part of the American founding, in a way, part of the Magna Carta, which is sort of the beginning of constitutional thought, in the English Empire, around the year 1030, the rediscovery in Italy of the Roman Empire's Justinian Pandects. That was a body of law, like the, you know, it was Rome's greatest hits of legal jurisprudence, basically. And when that was rediscovered many hundreds of years later, people looked at what was written down as a law and they said, this was a very successful culture. These were the rules of that culture. We can learn a lot from these rules. So that was that wasn't a rediscovery of the commands of Caesar. It was a rediscovery of the secular political compromise that is embodied in the rule of law. It was people's coming to terms of engagement with other traders. So I'll just say this. Think about the distinction between moral compromise and political compromise. Those are two different things. Moral compromise is when you can't do the right thing, you sort of do the next best thing. You compromise with moral principles. Political compromise is a whole different animal. Political compromise is coming face to face with beings that are at the center of their own universes. Their universe does not revolve around you, and your interests are not their interests, your goals are not their goals. They have lives of their own to live, and you have a life of your own to live. And so you say, I want this, and they say, well, we want this, and you say, I have to get what I want, not you. I have to win this one, you have to lose. And they say, you can't be assured that if we start fighting, I don't think you're going to win this. And so then you say, well, maybe we have an alternative to fighting then. Because I don't win the fight. I don't get what I want if we start fighting. So the idea of a political compromise is to say, I want to be able to be neighbors with people who want different things from what I want, believe different things, maybe even believe in a different God. I want us to be able to live side by side and not be terrorized by the fact of being neighbors. I want us to be able to live together in peace. That means I have to say, I want my community to be a safe place to pursue my dreams, but other people's dreams as well. I want other people's best option to be minding their own business and leaving me alone. That's political compromise, is realizing that the community you want to live in has to be a place to pursue hopes and dreams that you don't believe in.
Right. And what do you make of the argument that inequality produced by the market, by economic freedom, is a driver of violence, of social conditions that will produce at some point violence or a revolution or whatever? It has been very common in Chile to say that inequality is the reason why the country exploded, although the numbers show that inequality was going down. But the thing is, there is similarity with the argument that was made for the French Revolution. Although we didn't have poverty in the levels the French had back at the time, it's interesting to analyze the role of inequality or economic freedom are the markets instruments that would pacify society, or is the market, which is basically people, you know, engaging freely in economic activity, something that can produce results that in the end can blow up society or can produce this sort of violent outbreaks, or it has nothing to do with that? What's your opinion on that?
Well, thanks, Axel, for that question about the relationship between inequality and market society, commercial society, and violence. I would say there are so many different directions we could go in and maybe have to go in to explore that question. So we have to say, is there a kind of equality that's worth fighting for? Is there a kind of commerce, commercial society, terms of exchange that are worth fighting for? And we could say something like, what is it about market society that is not guaranteed to never end up like other kinds of societies, like Venezuela, or a place of tribal warfare? Why, you know, market societies rise above those things, and if they ever take a step backward, then they get blamed for taking a step backwards and for not being guaranteed. So a few things to say. So first of all, one of the special features of Western societies, Western commercial societies, is that they did in fact evolve in the direction of a kind of equality, in the direction of citizens being able to think of themselves as having a right to be treated as equals before the law. They weren't treated as a right to say equal income. They weren't treated as having a right to have one wage at the age of 18 and still have the same wage when they were 50 years old. Because that's one of the implications of equality, is that no one ever gets a raise. And that's not an equality that is, that kind of equality, that is war. There's never been any kind of society like that that has been anything other than a totalitarian dictatorship, and a very, very poor totalitarian dictatorship as well. So it's equality before the law that is a kind of mild, diluted egalitarianism, you could say, but it's actually the firmest and most profound equality there is. So to be a member of a liberal society and a commercial society like we find in the West, That's a society that does not naturally separate into upper and lower classes. It doesn't require that everyone should work the same number of hours. It doesn't require that everyone get paid the same wage. But there are other dimensions of equality that can promote liberty or be a precondition of a liberty worth having. Now, the rule of law in practice is never going to be more than approximation of equality. So there's never going to be an equality that guarantees that we're all the same age. There's never going to be an equality that determines that we all have the same level of alertness and sophistication and ability to identify an opportunity and run with it. That's not going to happen. So, you know, the most, viciously, violently egalitarian society you can imagine is actually going to be a society that runs on a black market. I mean, if you make it illegal to be alert, then alertness is going to go underground. And the alertness to opportunities to produce things that other people value and to make money by producing things that other people value, that's going to be expressed in one form or another. If you drive it underground, then it'll be more violent and less healthy. So, being young and inexperienced, uneducated, not having made good connections with people in key social positions, that is going to be a disadvantage, and nothing will ever be able to stop it from being a disadvantage. So whatever your dominant religion is, whatever your dominant tribe is, not being a member of that tribe is going to be a disadvantage.
Right.
Nothing could ever, there's never been any such thing as a society that got around that. You can't get around that. But I think what you might consider is inequality really the problem? Or is it a lack of some kind of baseline prospect? That might be the problem. So you might say the egalitarian dream a century ago might have been to drastically reduce the number of people who died before the age of 5, or drastically reduce the number of people who died of old age by the time that they were 45, where old age was partly a matter of malnutrition, and malnutrition was partly a result of people losing their teeth by the age of 30, say. So there have been societies that you would not want to live in, not because they were more unequal than ours. Actually, they were more equal, which means,
right,
like everybody, nobody lived very much longer than anybody else, because hardly anybody lived very long. And that's the, your life expectancy is the most important dimension of equality that there is. And so one thing that you would want to do is here's a question for civilization right now is, can you tie egalitarianism to self-interest? Because now it seems to be tying itself to vanity. It's the Hobbesian nightmare with a different name. So now the Hobbesian vanity egalitarian nightmare is the idea of the rich being the enemy, the successful being the enemy, and tearing them down. And if we could just tear them down by some magical process, we'll be better off. It isn't true. It's just vanity. It's a kind of insanity. It's a kind of homicidal viciousness. So there are kinds of equality that are respects for citizenship, that are ways of respecting neighbors, that are ways of being benevolent, and those are the kinds of equality that have emerged in different times and places, especially in Western civilization, and been the key to general flourishing for a while. So if you if you look at the, say, the ideologies that have been reemerging, they're old ideologies, but have been reemerging in recent years, just to say inequality is increasing. Now, what that means to say inequality is increasing, it means if you look hard enough, you will be able to find a dimension along which inequality is increasing. Now, it may be a dimension which the kind of people who care about that dimension of inequality are like people like professors, like people who are upper class, but not quite in the 1%. So those people are their vanity drives them to hate the 1% and to just want to tear the 1% down. And the excuse they make is to say, if they can tear the 1% down, then poor people will be better off. There is no connection, or if there's a connection, the connection goes the wrong way. And what actually happens, it's in recessions or depressions that inequality really starts to become, it's not exactly the disaster. Poverty is a disaster, but relative poverty in a depression can be literally lethal, and we are plunging into at least a recession right now, maybe a depression, and that is in fact going to be really bad for poor people. It's going to be really bad for racial minorities, and so on. And when people say that, and when they say, not only is the disease killing more Black people, but Black people are also at greater risk because they don't have life savings to draw on, that sort of thing. Those things are genuine problems. They're terrible problems, and they're problems that will result in there being more violence than ever in the ghettos, in the poor communities. So we have done the thing that is really dangerous, really lethal to the poor, which is we have basically torn down the rich. Not deliberately. I mean, it was a disease that closed all the businesses, a disease that closed the factories, that shut down the owners of capital. And so it's a terrible thing. If you said inequality is increasing now, I would say by the measures that were being used 6 months ago, that would be a lie. Inequality is radically increasing. Inequality is being crushed. Inequality is being driven into the ground, and we're all becoming more equal. And as a result, the inequality that actually matters, right, which is being poor, that is what's increasing. But the ways we've been measuring inequality, according to those measures, we're being leveled. We're being leveled now, but we're being leveled in a way that if we're all being driven to the point of starvation, it's the people who had less to begin with who were doing just fine. At least in America, we had full employment. Everybody who wanted a job had several alternative jobs that they could take. But that's no longer the case. And now we've gone from 3% unemployment in the space of like about 6 weeks. We've gone to 10%. We're probably on the way to 20% or 25%. And that is going to be the true egalitarian disaster. But the true egalitarian disaster is a function not of inequality, but of poverty.
Poverty. And as a result, you predict more violence, conflict, and deterioration of the social fabric. I mean, one could expect that, no? More criminality, more violence going on. We don't even know what's going to happen, but it's reasonable to assume that. We would have more equality, but more violence.
Right. So I don't know why some societies are obviously more violent than others, but it's obvious that some are. And I have to say, I don't know if there's something, I don't know what Tucson is like, the city where I live. I can say that at this point, Tucson is a moderately high crime city. There's quite a bit of burglary in general, and that has not, I read about places where crimes against property and crimes against person have increased. As far as I can tell, that has not happened in Tucson. I live in the middle of downtown, and so I actually live myself in the greatest concentration of blacks and ethnics in Tucson. And I didn't do that to be politically correct. I just did that because it was the most interesting part of the city. So in some sense, I would think that if I would be one of the first people to know if Tucson was becoming more violent. But in fact, when I do go out for a walk, I go out for walks several times a day. When I go out for a walk, people are talking to each other. People wave to each other. Even people driving by in their cars, they wave to each other and smile, and they'll say hello. And we don't shake hands or anything like that because of the social distancing. But there is a sense in which what has emerged is just an extra little dimension of people going out of their way to signal that they are benevolent, that they are glad to see you, and that they wish you well. So that's happening in Tucson. Now, so if anything, Tucson is more peaceful than it was a couple of months ago. Now, is that peace fragile? I don't know. I suppose so. There are a lot of guns in Tucson. It's, you know, Tucson is kind of the Wild West. And to my knowledge, those guns, like I could hear gunshots because I live downtown. I could hear gunshots months ago, but I haven't heard gunshots in the last month. So I don't know if it seems that if anything, Tucson has become more peaceful. But I feel for, you know, anybody in places where the violence has increased. Now, we know that there's sort of inequality can be a source of violence. But I think that when we talk about places I know just a little bit about, not really Santiago, but I was in Bogota when the riots were happening in Santiago. They were also happening in a more limited way in Bogota. And in a way, that wasn't inequality. That was the ideology, a particular ideology of inequality that was driving people to violence. That was an ideology that says, you need to understand that the rich are a different tribe, and they are a hostile tribe, and they are parasites, and you will be better off. You will make the world safe for your tribe if you can destroy that enemy tribe. So that wasn't inequality. That was tribalism driven by ideology. And the name that it used was inequality, but it wasn't really about inequality. It was about zero-sum thinking, driving.
Right. Which is very similar, in my opinion, to what happened here and what probably will happen when once this emergency is over. But David, I wanted to thank you because taking already like 15 minutes of your time, it has been a fascinating conversation. I will give you, when we have the printed interview, an edition of Atomo, and also, of course, I will send you your book as soon as possible. And let's see how it evolves, and we can organize a visit here to Chile, because we are very eager to have you here presenting your book and all that.
Thank you. Well, the the part of Santiago and parts of Chile west of Santiago that your wonderful friend Leon Montez has shown me. It was a very memorable, wonderful experience, and in some ways one of the best times I've ever had in my life.
Really? Oh my God!
he's a wonderful person, and it's a beautiful country, and the neighborhoods that he showed me were beautiful neighborhoods.
Yeah, we should go to a vineyard next time when you're here. We have very nice vineyards, very close to Santiago.
I would love to celebrate our survival in that way. I would love to do that once we get through this crisis. So I will look forward to that.
Bye, David. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye, Axel.
Bye-bye.